Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bown. Just remember, you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 100 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Dr. Leo Ruigby about his prize-winning essay, The Ghost in the Time Machine, The Survival of Human Consciousness After Permanent Bodily Death. Dr. Ruigby is an associate of King's College London, is a visiting fellow in psychology at the University of Northampton, where he is a member of the Exceptional Experiences and Consciousness Studies Research Group. He is closely involved in the work of the Society for Psychical Research as a member of council, former editor of its magazine, and a member of its Spontaneous Cases Committee. He has been elected a fellow of both the Royal Historical Society and the Royal Anthropological Institute. Hi, Leo. Thanks a lot for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Thanks, Simon. I'm very much delighted to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
We're going to be talking about the essay you wrote for the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies. The essay is called The Ghost in the Machine. And you start off with the Scrooge paradox. So could you describe that for us?
Yes, absolutely. Sorry to start with a correction, but the title is The Ghost in the Time Machine. Yeah, because, I mean, The Ghost in the Machine is the familiar term, but as we kind of delve further into this, you'll see the significance of me throwing that word in there. You know, the whole thing, when the competition was announced, it caused a big stir. And, you know, it was there was a story about it in the New York Times and everything. And really, there'd been nothing like this in the field of parapsychology, and especially in the kind of survival research field. There'd been nothing like this before. So it was really something big, something new. And as you know, there was a substantial amount of money being put up for the winners of this competition. So, you know, it was a big carrot that was being offered. And, you know, just personally, I'd always kind of been on the fence with the question of life after death. You know, I'd been looking at this subject for so long, because it seems that it touches on everything else that I'd been studying. The evidence was always compelling on the one hand, and then not on the other. So it seemed as though every time you found some case that was very strong, there would be some argument or some counter case that would really blow the whole thing out of the water again. So I was in this position of kind of, you know, flip-flopping, and didn't really know what to make of the whole subject, to be honest. And the contest presented this golden, almost literally golden opportunity to just sit down and finally work through this problem and think, you know, if I can't really convince anyone else, can I at least convince myself and answer this once and for all? You know, is there really life after death? And just doing my research, my initial research, there are a whole host of fairly well-trammeled subjects, you know, things like the near-death experience and ghosts and hauntings and all this that relates to what we suppose is the afterlife in some way. And just, you know, sifting through all of this material, I came across a quote from Charles Dickens, and it was from A Christmas Carol, and it was an incident with Scrooge right at the beginning of the story, and he sees the ghost of his former partner, Marley, for the first time. You know, he's been doing his usual Scrooge activities. He's not giving anyone time off for Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. And he's sort of reveling in his own misery. And then the ghost of Marley, his former partner, appears. And if I can just quote you this section, because it's quite nice. The ghost says to him, he has the first line here, says, "You don't believe in me," observed the ghost. "I don't," said Scrooge. "What evidence would you have of my reality beyond that of your senses?" "I don't know," said Scrooge. Why do you doubt your senses? Because, says Scrooge, a little thing affects a slight disorder of the stomach makes some cheats. You might be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of the grave about you, whatever you are. So it's a lovely kind of comedic moment, but it sums up, I thought, for me, this common experience that we all have, that even if we saw a ghost, we tend to try and explain it away. And so that, in a sense, is what I call the Scrooge paradox, that seeing is not always believing, that we doubt the evidence of our senses. And the question is, why? Why do we do that? Because we have, you know, millennia of accounts from people who have seen ghosts, you know, not just fictional ones like Marley, but real ghosts. And today, at this point in time, in the West, ghosts are really seen as something of, you know, it's a subject for horror films, for kind of, you know, for Halloween and little children. And it's, you know, if it doesn't fit into those neat categories, then it's not dealt with, and you really shouldn't believe in these things at all. And you go, well, why is that? Why have we reached this point, despite the fact that we have all of this testimony from other people? I mean, really, you know, reaching way back and from very reliable sources. And very many people today have had these sorts of experiences themselves. So it's always struck me that, you know, what we call the paranormal is not really outside of the normal, but it's very much a part of the normal. The number of people who have these experiences is astonishing. And that's why I always think of it as being normal. And so the question is, why don't we go with it? Why don't we believe our senses or the senses of other people? And largely it's to do with this taboo that's been developed by, you know, modern, let's call it scientism, you know, materialism, that's more ideological than it is scientific, and is presenting a particular worldview. And that's what we all have to kind of accept if we're going to be taken seriously. And so my argument is that this example from Charles Dickens really sums up this problem that we have, that we are all in this kind of Scrooge paradox. And it's about time that we did something about it and stop blaming our indigestion and, you know, blots of mustard and crumbs of cheese and all the rest of it. You know, in modern terms, that would be looking at psychological explanations for seeing or hearing things, you know, putting people in certain categories, you know, on a spectrum of psychosis and all this sort of thing. Whereas that isn't really the case at all. It's interesting that there's been some research now into, let's take hearing voices, because that's been a, shall we say, a hallmark of, you know, the extreme psychotic states, to start hearing voices and then acting on them, and usually it has very bad consequences. But some researchers discovered, well, you know, let's look at some other people who claim to hear voices. And the best group for that were mediums, because, of course, mental mediums will, you know, you've seen them at work. I'm sure many people in your audience may have actually gone and seen mediums themselves, and they will appear to have conversations with unseen participants, unseen by us, that is. And so we just hear one side of that conversation, and they're hearing the responses inside their own minds. So these researchers were able to take the two different sets, people who were diagnosed as, you know, psychotic, and people who were practicing mediums, both hearing voices, and then look at that and say, is there a difference in how they hear these voices and in these people themselves? And they were able to clearly define that psychotic hearing of voices is quite different from mediumistic hearing of voices. So, I mean, you know, there are corners of science now which are kind of catching up on where we should be and beginning to break down some of those taboos and barriers. But essentially, they're still there. If you attempted to present, you know, my paper at, say if I'd sent it to Nature to be published by the, you know, prestigious journal there, they would throw it out immediately. And And that's not because it's not a good paper. It's because it just doesn't fit the accepted view of the world. And I think we've got to challenge that. And I hope that that's one thing, at least that, you know, my essay and the others are definitely doing is challenging preconceptions, challenging the Scrooge paradox.
You say in the book that you've had experiences yourself, but you've also said that you've kind of explained them away. Could you tell us one of these experiences and how you explained it away?
Yeah, that's a good one, because that's exactly right. I've Scrooged myself in this regard. You know, I've doubted the reality of my own senses, and essentially because of the reasons that we've just gone over. I mean, a great example, was when I was doing a research on witchcraft. So this was back in London in the 1990s, and I was sitting in this hall and in London, and it was a very nice building, very charming building. And usually for my research, I would be doing this kind of participant observation, as we call it. So it's basically to take part in it, you know, get in there and do it to see what it is, to fully be able to understand, you know, things like ritual and the community and so on, is to, you know, try and be part of it. But this time I was kind of, I don't know why, but I decided to sit up in, you know, the upper circle and not join in and not sort of be in the audience, but just completely observe it. And I'm glad I did, actually, because it was an amazing ritual that this group put on. It was very well rehearsed and very well executed. And, you know, I've seen some quite ropey rituals being performed where people have forgotten their lines and, you know, all that sort of thing. But this one was very much, I was going to say professional production, but, you know, it wasn't professional production, but it was at a very high level of production. And so I was up in this circle, you know, looking down and recording the audio of the ritual. And it was really quite amazing. And as it was, you know, building up to the climax of the ceremony, you could really feel, this sense that the air was quite electric. There was a real energy there. And however you might want to define or measure that, you could just kind of feel something. You know, it was very dramatic and quite exciting. And the audience were all being sort of, you know, whipped up to a frenzy down below. And just at the climax of the ceremony, out of the corner of my eye, I'm sitting up in this circle and it's all dark up there and I'm the only person there. And I hadn't really thought about that until this moment. I saw something out of the side of my eye, and it appeared to be a human figure, you know, resting on the railings and looking down at the scene. And the unusual thing about this human figure was that it was made out of fire, right? So it was just this kind of Burning Man type figure with a big pleased expression, a big grin on his face, watching the ceremony. And as I turned around and looked at it, it wasn't there anymore. And I could just see the exit sign way at the other end of the circle and this vast, empty expanse of darkness. And you know, at the time I thought, wow, that was interesting. And there were a few things to the ceremony that was being performed. And it was a sort of mixed group of ceremonial magicians, witches, and, chaos magicians and so on. So it was a mixed group of these people. And they were doing an invocation of Horus. And, you know, as we know, Horus is the Egyptian solar deity. And so, you know, this kind of tied in, although the figure wasn't presented in any of the typical depictions of Horus, this kind of fire element was, you know, certainly solar. So it matched what was going on. But of course, I'm thinking, well, here I am. I'm sitting up. I'm all on my lonesome up in the circle. I'm looking down on this scene. And it's a very charged atmosphere. It's a very psychologically heightened atmosphere. And I'm in a state of, you know, heightened engagement myself. And that would be a very conducive circumstance to have some sort of psychological event that may not actually be real. Okay, so, you know, an hallucination. And then this sort of corner of the eye phenomena is, you know, it's quite well documented that people see things at the corner of their eye. They look and they don't see what it is that they thought they saw. And it seems to be that, you know, the peripheral vision is less accurate than your forward vision. And the brain constructs patterns out of incomplete data that it receives from the peripheral. And this tends to lead to, you know, these kind of hallucinations. So there was a whole ton of explanations as to why I would just see something that wasn't there. But of course, my experience, you know, being there and at an invocation of Horus and seeing a man of fire actually enjoying the invocation, you think, wow, they invoked him, or did they just invoke my hallucination? So that was my main Scrooge paradox moment, I would say. I mean, there've been others, but I think that's probably the best.
Yeah, well, it's good to be skeptical, isn't it? You can't just accept everything and say, yeah, that's definitely paranormal.
yes, of course. I mean, I say yes. That's certainly not what I'm arguing, that we should just kind of throw away caution and just run into this phenomena and saying, yeah, it's all true and, you know, wonderful and open your eyes. No, absolutely not. I mean, I'm a very skeptical person myself. And, you know, throughout the writing of the essay, I maintained that skepticism, despite coming up with this Scrooge paradox thing. You know, we do need to question our senses, certainly, because in some circumstances, people do have, you know, for example, hallucinations or whatever that can be explained psychologically rather than, say, paranormally. So, yeah, I'm definitely not arguing to just throw caution to the wind and leap into this as some sort of leap of faith. Absolutely not. And I hope that comes through, you know, not just in this essay, but just generally in all my work. You know, one example was also going to 30, was it East Drive? You know, the scene of the Black Monk of Pontefract. And again, I went there on the 50th anniversary of the original Poltergeist case. And I joined in with a group of ghost hunters who were actually there for like half the evening. They'd taken the place for half the evening and I got to stay on for the whole night. And again, that was another really wonderful example of psychological priming, you know, because it had this really rich backstory that just kind of, you know, it's already sending shivers down your spine before you get there. And the neighbor who had the key told me a whole bunch of stories, which, you know, just enhanced that.
Yeah.
And so there were, I could kind of, you know, I wrote an article about it because I could really observe myself getting into this state. And you do get into a kind of state of heightened awareness in which a lot of things that you would just generally ignore, you know, these are kind of random background sounds or whatever, you suddenly pay really acute attention to them because you're on your own in a haunted house. So every creak becomes something, you know, whereas if you were just at home, in your normal family home with your family around you, and you heard a creak, you would just think nothing of it. So there are things that come into play that you do have to be aware of, you know, to stop yourself just falling down, I guess you're falling down the rabbit hole, maybe falling down the wrong rabbit hole, as it were. Because, you know, the mind does play tricks on itself, and we do have to be aware of that.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about a case in the essay that really does seem quite more than that, which was the plumber's apprentice, Harry Martindale. So could you describe what he saw?
Yeah, I think this is a great case. It's very well known. And so what I'll do is I'll put it in context, because another thing with Charles Dickens, it wasn't just this example of, you know, Scrooge and developing the Scrooge paradox. When I started reading, you know, Christmas Carol again, it has these three ghosts that take Scrooge on you know, little sort of visionary adventures to see what kind of, you know, lies in store and all the rest of it. And he has the ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas yet to come. And I thought, wow, here, you know, Scrooge is actually traveling through time with these so-called ghosts. So, you know, spirit is taking him on some kind of temporal adventures, and he's able to witness the past, the present, of course, and also the future, as if they exist all together as now. You know, there's the past hasn't gone, so he can still go and visit it. The future isn't unwritten because he can go forward and see what's in the future. And then he can also leave his physical present and travel in spirit in the present. So I thought, wow, this is interesting, because this actually ties in with modern physics, bizarrely. So there's the Einstein's mathematics teacher Minkowski came up with this model of four-dimensional space-time, which was the basis for Einstein's theory of relativity, and it's since called Einstein-Minkowski space-time. So it's this idea of four dimensions of, you know, three dimensions of space that we're aware of, plus a time dimension. And together they form a so-called, block universe. And in this block, past, present, and future exist all at the same time. And this is what really made me use the Christmas Carol, because I thought this fits with this model of the universe from physics. And if we look beyond simply a fictional investigation, just look beyond fiction, I think, do we have observers or experiencers or witnesses of this model of the universe? And I thought, yes, we do. If I look at all the stuff I've been researching over the years, we've got people seeing the ghosts that appear to be in the past. We've got people who seem to be leaving their present body in out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. And we've got people apparently seeing or going into the future in, you know, premonitions and precognition. And I thought, wow, we've got those witnesses that fit this model of physics. And this is where the example that you mentioned fits in so well. So this is where the story that you referred to comes in, and it's such a key part of my whole thesis here. So we had 18-year-old plumber's apprentice, Harry Martindale, and he's in the cellars of the treasurer's house in York. And he's working on their central heating system there. And as he described it, he's kind of like, he's perched on a ladder, and he's, you know, he's, whatever he's doing, he's banging away on this central heating system, probably cursing it for not working. And then he hears this distant blaring of a note, as he described it. So it's like some kind of trumpet or something, which is not what you expect when you're in a cellar. And he said that he looked down from his ladder, and he sees this figure wearing a plumed helmet and holding a trumpet-like instrument. And he just comes out through the wall, followed by a horse and a rider. And then, as if that's not enough, a whole column of Roman soldiers come out after that. So apparently, poor old Harry fell off his ladder with fright. And he's lying there in this cellar, and he watches about 20 soldiers marching across the cellar. And he was able to see that they were just coming out of a wall. So it was as if the wall wasn't there. And then he also noticed that they also seemed to be walking through the floor. So they seemed to be following a path that had no bearing on current reality. You know, so they were coming through a wall, they were walking through the floor, and, you know, this didn't really make any sense to him. But he noted all of these details, and he made some notes on how the Roman soldiers looked themselves. You know, I think this is also quite interesting, because we all have a certain kind of vision of what a Roman soldier looks like, and he described it as the the Charlton Heston type, you know, that they would all be looking very spick and span, and, you know, everything would be shiny and new leather and all the rest of it. He said that it was, they were quite the opposite. They all looked very battered and, you know, kind of dusty and all the rest of it. And he noted a certain sort of shield that they were carrying. And, you know, these sorts of details were later examined. And the shield is interesting because it wasn't the kind of large square shield. You know, this was a rectangular shield that we kind of associate with the Roman legionaries. But a small sort of round shield with a raised boss in the center. And a local historian was able to later match this to the type of unit that would have been stationed at York roughly that time. So that gave a nice little additional bit of evidence to something that wasn't just imagination. You know, if it had just been imagination, he would have seen the typical view that we're used to from all of the films, right? But instead he saw something that was different. And then it came to this whole aspect of the figures coming out of the wall and walking through the floor. And later excavations found that the old Roman road actually went through this cellar. So the building, the treasurer's house had been built on top of the old Roman road and covered it up, built a cellar on top of it, et cetera, et cetera. And they dug down about a foot or something and found the true level of where the old road would have been. And this matched approximately where Harry saw the soldiers marching. You know, so when they actually marched, they marched on this road. There was no treasurer's house there. So in their reality, they weren't walking through a wall and they weren't walking through a floor. They were walking on the wall that was there. So this example, it seems to be that he really sees something that is in the past and still happening in the past. So it's not that kind of modern ghost sighting type idea that we have. I mean, this is especially influenced by film and fiction and so on, in which ghosts interact with us and seem to be part of our reality. And here he saw these figures, we can call them ghosts, but it seems as though it was actually them. Somehow he was able to see these soldiers in the past walking along this route as they were doing it. And so that keyed in with this thesis that I was working on, that we have, you know, witness testimony to this idea of a block universe. So Harry saw the past as if it still existed, which totally fits this model of the universe that Einstein and Minkowski came up with. So I think that's, you know, it's a dramatic story in itself, and it's wonderfully told by Harry Martindale. I mean, he actually spend some time not telling anyone about this because he was frightened of being ridiculed. And the doctor afterwards had, you know, sent him home to kind of recover from it and all the rest of it. But, you know, eventually he spoke out and he kept this very strong memory of the whole incident. And we're just lucky that he did find the courage to tell this story. Because again, you know, he had to overcome everyone else's Scrooge paradox before he could really just come out with this. So it's a wonderful story and really illustrates the bigger argument that I'm trying to drive forward in this essay.
And didn't he go upstairs and he saw the museum's curator who said to him, by the look of you, you've seen the Roman soldiers?
That's right. That's a really nice incident. Yeah, so when he kind of gets his wits together, you know, after he's just fallen off the ladder and he's lying on the floor there, and he gets his wits together and scrambles out of there as fast as he can and does indeed meet a gentleman on the stairs who says, you know, by the looks of it, you've seen the Roman soldiers too. So that was a nice little aspect to show that it wasn't just something he had seen, but other people had seen it too.
Hi, this is Simon. Do you have a fascination with reincarnation? and would you like to know about your past lives? I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy, and I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom. If you'd like to find out how a session works for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website. That's at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. And it makes you wonder what the mechanism is there that it would trigger that, either a connection to the past, or some people would suggest it's some kind of a recording.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually had a huge section in the essay on the whole, you know, recording, the stone tape theory, which I had to cut down at the end because it was, we had a certain limit of words on the essay that we couldn't go above, so I had to cut down quite a lot. But I think the stone tape theory is one of the sort of more persistent ideas that somehow things are being recorded in the environment. I mean, this is problematic on a number of accounts because, you know, what's it being recorded by? You know, if you think about how we actually record things, it's quite a complicated process. You know, you need a specific technology, you know, your camera to record, to actually bring in that light, focus it and put it on a recording material that is in itself, you know, if you think about the old magnetic tape that was used, you know, there's a lot of moving parts, we might say, in this process. So if you're just in an old cellar, you know, what is actually doing the recording? Is it just not this what is it? The stone wall itself, it's impossible for it to actually record and then store any sort of data at that level. And then where's the playback mechanism? You know, there's nothing to actually play it back either. So I think that it's a superficially interesting explanation, but when you break it down, it doesn't really work. This whole stone tape theory. There's nothing to record. There's nothing to play back. And then you also have to think about factors that would come into play if there were those mechanisms, which would be the deterioration of the image over time. You know, all of our recording technologies deteriorate so that, you know, a film of 100 years ago is usually in very poor quality. And we're talking about maybe 2,000 years in this case, recorded by something that would just be, you know, a block of stone. So, you know, the image, and to be played back in such three-dimensional holographic quality, which is beyond our ability now, is completely implausible. And I think that what we're seeing instead is really the nature of consciousness. So one thing is that people, very typically, they will see ghosts when they're in a distracted frame of mind. You know, they will be doing some kind of monotonous task or engaged in something that just isn't really kind of thrilling. So they're almost in a sort of semi-hypnotic kind of state, or they're distracted, or they're focused on a job or something like that. So it's a particular kind of state. And then they'll see something that they maybe don't even recognize as a ghost initially, because it very often just looks like a person. And then it'll be some aspect of that person, what they're wearing or how they behave. You know, they don't respond when spoken to or just disappear. That then leads that person to think, oh my God, I've just seen a ghost. And those aspects are interesting because that's kind of what fits in with what Harry saw. You know, he was focused on his job and distracted by that. He wasn't ghost hunting, and witnessed this thing. And, you know, he saw three-dimensional, holographic, I'm going to say replay, but no, not replay. He really saw the past as if it was still there. And this is something that I developed through the whole essay, is to show that consciousness really exists on a level that is this, you know, block universe level. So when we look at people's near-death experiences, for example, and a common aspect of that will be the life review. People will say that, you know, they leave their body and they're then shown essentially a kind of replay of their lives. But they're very often in a certain sort of spatial relationship to this replay. So they're able to see it from all sorts of angles, as if they can just observe it, as if it's still happening. And they're able to experience the emotions of the other participants in their lives, which they weren't able to do when they were alive. So the other aspects of evidence that come from things like near-death experiences show that consciousness, when it's released from or separated from the physical, and that can be either through something as traumatic as actually dying, or through a particular state in which that person is focused or distracted, they can actually, the consciousness can see the universe as it is. And that's kind of mind-bending suggestion, I suppose. But I think that's the key thing, because there's so many other examples of this. You know, there was a case that I covered of a maid who was hypnotized during the First World War. And initially the guy that owned the house and employed this maid just wasn't really very satisfied with her work. So a friend of his suggested that he hypnotize her and, you know, to make her work better, which I'm sure wouldn't fly in today's society. So he did that. He hypnotized her. And through the process of being hypnotized, she spontaneously had what we might call something like viewing experience, and then they called it traveling clairvoyance. So she was able to leave apparent reality and travel forward to the front line in Europe, and actually see her fiancé. And, you know, what he was doing at that time, and report back on that. So it was a great example of how consciousness was able to operate without regard to space. And if we look at, you know, Harry Martindale's experience, consciousness there is operating without regard to time. And again, this is something that happens in near-death experiences with, you know, life review. And they also have life preview, you know, the people can actually see what's in store for them in the future as well, which is a kind of slightly more rarely reported occurrence, but it's still reported. So these all really just fall together into this pattern showing that we do live in a block universe, and that consciousness in certain states is able to experience that.
And there's something I wanted to ask about the soldiers, the Roman soldiers. They didn't react to Martin at all. It's like they were in their own environment. But you have cases in the book where perhaps the ghost sees the person as well. You're the future ghost and they're the past ghost.
Yes, exactly. There was a really good example of that, because I think you know, even though consciousness can apparently operate at this level, or perhaps that's even its natural level, the Roman soldiers were very much engaged in just marching along their road and didn't appear to notice Harry, you know, lying at the side, looking completely bewildered as they passed by. But as you mentioned, there was a case that I came across in which the person apparently saw a ghost, and this ghost seemed to see them as well, which is remarkable. And it happens extremely rarely. There are very few cases of this, but both of them seem to have been in a similar frame of mind in which they were able to do so. And yes, the So the gentleman in our kind of present saw someone who was in like a maid in Victorian clothing and was looking into the past, but she looked up and saw him. And of course, she was looking into the future, or what appeared to be the future in that moment, and must have been extremely bewildered to see this man standing there looking at her and wearing, you know, modern clothes. So yeah, that was an amazing case to come across, because it did seem to show that it can be a two-way process.
Yeah, because I've heard of something like that before. There was in America, somebody was walking around their house, and it was a really old, big house, and they walked to where the kitchen was, and they found this scene from, looked like the Victorian era, and this family sitting around the table having dinner. And one of the men at the table looked up and saw her and said, "Well, would you look at that?" And then the scene just disappeared.
Yeah. I know. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could find somebody's ghost story from the past in which they saw somebody, you know, from our present or even the future? That would be, if somebody had written that down, that would be quite amazing, wouldn't it?
So you've got so much stuff in the essay, so many different things. I wanted to ask you about something you say. Does the evidence need to be extraordinary?
This is the old chestnut for kind of, what is it? Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof or whatever. What I'm saying is that this claim isn't extraordinary. You know, this is really, we have, it matches, so all these things match what modern physics is telling us about the universe. And so it might look extraordinary because, you know, modern physics is pretty mind-bending, you know, when you try and get into it. But it does seem that we do have the evidence, this kind of witness testimony to match that theory. And I don't think, you know, this sort of extraordinary argument is almost a way of trying to limit the evidence, because, you know, what is extraordinary? You can always come back at any sort of evidence and say, well, I wasn't extraordinary enough. I mean, you know, maybe Harry Martindale, his experience, was it extraordinary? What, maybe somebody said, well, he should have done this or that, spoken to the ghosts, or, you know, done something else. Or it's always going to be less than extraordinary, the evidence, for somebody who doesn't want to hear the evidence, you know. So it's a way of limiting the evidence. And my argument is rather that we're not dealing with the paranormal, we're dealing with the normal. And it's only because our perception of reality and our kind of ideological blinkers stop us from really appreciating that.
And so there was something set up called the Premonitions Bureau in 1967. And that was that because of the thing that happened in Wales?
Yeah, absolutely. That was really interesting, actually. So the whole beginning of the story, and it goes back to a series of premonitions in 1966, October 14, 1966, we've got the first sort of premonitions being recorded, and people were able to, you know, say things to other people who could then verify they'd said that, or some had even made sketches that they were then able to show that they'd had, you know, this premonition. And they were quite dramatic, and they were coming from people all over the country, as well as from the village in Wales where this terrible accident happened itself. So that, you know, for example, one girl was going to school, and she'd had this dream, and it was their last day of school, and she told her mother about the dream before she went off. And she said that she went to school and there wasn't anything there, and something black, she said, had come down all over it. And, you know, as we know that, Yeah, it's a terrible story, really. So the girl that had this dream, she was at the junior school in Aberfan in Wales, and it was their last day before the holidays, and it was a coal mining village, and above the village there was this you get these kind of slag heaps, where they put the spoil from the mining activities. And some of these heaps had become sort of hugely water saturated, and then started to move and turned into this huge landslide, which just, it came down and really destroyed the village. And unfortunately, the school was one of the buildings worst hit. It was just completely buried. So there were over 100 children died in that. It a really heartbreaking event to think that this whole community is just devastated by this, and the shockwaves across the country as well were enormous. But the amazing thing from looking at it from our investigation is that people had these premonitions in respect of it. And it's unfortunate that nobody took any action based on these premonitions. And that's essentially where the idea for the Premonitions Bureau came about. So there was a psychiatrist, Dr. John Barker. He initially became interested in the disaster because he heard that a survivor had died of fright. And, he was interested in learning more about that mechanism in which somebody can undergo the most extreme transformation, go from life to death, just based on their psychological reaction to something. And he was a member of the Society for Psychical Research and was writing a book on this, what he called psychic death, and wanted to investigate it further. In doing so, he went down to Aberfan and he heard stories about the premonitions that people had, and he started investigating this further. And he got in touch with a guy at a newspaper, and they published an appeal for these premonitions. And, within a couple of weeks, they received a huge number of replies. And then another newspaper joined in and gathered more replies from people. So a couple of interesting things came together then that really generated a huge body of evidence that we just haven't had before or since from an event like that. And it was to see how much was out there, how many people had premonitions in respect of this, that made this guy Barker think, well, what if I set up an organization that would be like an early warning system of where people who have premonitions could send them to me, and I would be then able to alert the rest of society about any impending doom or whatever might be on the horizon, which, what a fantastic idea. And he certainly had the evidence there for it. And so he went ahead and he set up this Premonitions Bureau. And again, the same newspaper, the Evening Standard, helped him solicit the premonitions from the general public. And a few people got in touch with him that were kind of like his star performers. They really seemed to have a hotline to the future. Excuse me. And he started getting premonitions about, things like plane crashes. There was one involving a cosmonaut dying in space. He didn't die in space. He died when the parachute failed to open as his capsule re-entered, and it just smashed into the ground at full speed because the Russians used to land their men on the land itself, whereas the Americans would land them into the ocean. So people were contacting him with these premonitions, and they were just startling. If I think about what would be the best one, possibly the assassination of Robert Kennedy. So Barker got some messages You know, initially somebody wrote in and said there's going to be another assassination, maybe in America shortly. And somebody else wrote in and said, I get the name Robert Kennedy. And this was all, you know, in spring of 1968. And his one star performer called Middleton was really getting a number of strong messages with regard to this. And yeah, it was quite astonishing because Robert F. Kennedy was later assassinated. We got forewarning of that. It's an interesting thing because although we're talking about the essay here, and it was for the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies, I'm now working at the Institute, and we ran a program from 2023 to 2024 involving mediums. And this is all up on our website. We called it the challenge. So it was the idea was that it would be the next step on from the contest, the essay contest. So the essay contest was to establish the evidence, and the challenge program was to go beyond that and say, well, what would the other side, whatever it might be, and what would the sources, whatever they might be, have to say to us that would be of benefit to, you know, the humankind at large. And we called it wisdom acquisition. And one of the things that we wanted to ask in respect of that was to have some, you know, a couple of questions that we could check against real world events, you know, to see, you know, again, being a little skeptical of the mediums. One of the things we asked them was about the US presidential election. And we got a number of replies on that. And we actually got somebody saying that they had a kind of, well, essentially a premonition of an assassination attempt being made against Trump. And she wasn't able to tell if it was successful or not. And, you know, as we know, it wasn't. So, you know, we actually had information coming through that was like the Premonitions Bureau data that was being received. So people do see these future events. You know, probably luckily we don't all see it all of the time, because this would be a very difficult way to live your life if you could just, you know, be aware of everything all of the time. And this really brings me into the idea that, you know, the brain is, its function, amongst other things, is to filter consciousness so that we're not overwhelmed by the amount of information that consciousness can actually access. But some people are able to go, you know, break through the filter or circumvent the filter and have these premonitions.
One thing about the premonitions, and I don't know if this is because they asked for them to be like this, but it seems like they're always bad. Do people have premonitions for something really good?
It's a good question, isn't it? Yeah. It's sort of like, if you think about maybe this is also a bit of a survival mechanism, because you think you usually get a bad feeling about something, you know, that might prevent you from doing something. As opposed to getting a good feeling, you're going to continue with your actions anyway. So it seems as though this is all part of, you know, thinking about how our mind is really initially intended to function. And it needs to constantly scan the environment for potential threats. And so consciousness can do this also. So I think it's the potential threats that are coming through. But the interesting thing is that some of these people are completely unconnected to the actual potential threat. So it doesn't affect them in any way, but they're still able to get that information. And yes, it does always seem to be bad news. And I can only think of it being some sort of, you know, some Darwinian aspect to that it actually serves a purpose.
Well, we've almost run out of time We've been talking about your essay, The Ghost in the Machine. Do you have a website?
I do, yes. It's simply my name. So it's rookby.com. It sounds easy enough, but my name is horrifically difficult to spell. So it's RUICKBIE.com. And you just find a kind of overview of who I am and the sort of things I've been working on over the years. And it's a good starting place. There are other bits and pieces on the internet where you can find more about me, but that's a good starting place, rookby.com.
Great. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
It's been lovely. I really enjoyed talking to you, Simon, and thanks for having me on the show. I hope I've been able to enlighten some of your listeners or at least entertain them.
So this week I was talking to Dr. Leo Rueckby about his prize-winning essay, The Ghost in the Time Machine, The Survival of Human Consciousness After Permanent Bodily Death. And a great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon. When you subscribe for $6 a month, you get exclusive access to an extended episode every week. And for $3 a month, you get access to an extended episode every month. And you can now sign up for a 7-day free trial. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And you can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastlifeshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And look out for the Our Paranormal Afterlife episodes called Paranormal Stories that are released every Tuesday. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.